Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I take what you pay, but I got to put you down for a while. Well, you know I take what you pay, but I got to put you down.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. I'm Patrick Connor of course, Knuckles and Gloves, The Fight City, a couple other places, and needless to say, as many of you know, also the host of the Hannibal Boxing Podcast. In just a moment, my homeboy, Bryn Jonathan Butler, is going to be with us. We're going to be previewing Errol Spence Jr. versus Sean Porter, the pay-per-view that's going down tonight. So I guess we're probably relying on people listening in live for the most part. There probably aren't going to be too many people listening back before the actual main event tonight. But nonetheless, this is just a way for us to get our Jones in, to get the shake the cobwebs out, you know, lift the spirits and whatnot. Bryn should be with us in just a moment. So I guess I'm not going to lie, though. There's going to be at least a portion of the show where we talk about whether or not today should even be a pay-per-view. Straight up last night, so I do not have cable, like many other people. No longer do. I haven't had cable for probably, trying to think, maybe 5 years, something like that. Somewhere in that realm. Might be a little bit longer. But for the most part, I'll keep this fairly short, I promise. I know you guys know how I love to ramble, but for the most part, I got sick of paying, you know, it was like almost $200 a month all told when it came down to the internet bill. Of course, you have to bundle it with a fucking landline with all of the like Comcast and all these different types of places to get any sort of reasonable discount. But basically, I got sick of paying, you know, for the cable. Like I got HBO, I had Showtime, had all of these things because I wanted to stay up on boxing. And, you know, I got a DVR for when I wasn't home so that I could record that shit, then come back and watch it later in HD. You know, and of course it was like an extra $15 a month to get everything in HD, but there were only limited channels in HD, blah, blah, blah. You guys already know all this shit. And that was like 5 years ago. So I got sick of doing that, ditched cable. And so ever since then we've had a Roku, or we've had, I think we've had a, what do you call it? One of those other little Google dealios that is probably at this point obsolete, Google Cast or whatever, Chromecast. And, anyway, I was flipping on the Roku yesterday and I saw an ad for Errol Spence versus Sean Porter. And it was on Sling TV. Sling TV is the app where you can watch live TV, even if you don't have cable. So I was like curious, you know, is this going to be some sort of discount or something like that? Cause it's through Sling, or because it's not, you know, going through a terrestrial cable, as it were, a cable company. And the price tag that I had kept, that I kept reading was $70 or $69.95. Sure enough, when I click on here, it's actually $75. So I don't know what the fuck, man. There's going to be a fucking discussion on that for sure. What up, Bryn? Bryn? Hello? You there?
Sorry, just one sec.
Oh, yeah, no worries. Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm out of line with the price tag, and maybe people have just kind of become conditioned to, you know, Bryn will be right back. I think he had to just kind of call in and drop out real quick. As everybody knows, he's a busy dude, man about town, who's always trekking around New York City and shit during the show. So he'll be back in just a moment, I'm sure. But maybe it's just that people have become kind of conditioned that, like, if there's going to be a pay-per-view, then the assumption is that that fight's a big fight or an important fight or something that warrants pay-per-view. And if it does warrant pay-per-view, if it does indeed warrant pay-per-view, then it's going to be $60, $70, $80 or something like that. And that's just kind of the expectation. That's stupid. I mean, I don't really know how else to express that. I think that that mindset where you just kind of like mindlessly buy shit is stupid, but nonetheless, here we are. And here Bryn is. What up, dude? You back?
I'm back. Technical issues, but we're good.
Oh, no worries, dude. No worries. The Blog Talk, we've been on the show for like 6 years or something like that on Blog Talk Radio, and I'm pretty sure that by now my middle name is Technical Dick Difficulties. Technical Dick, too, but Technical Difficulties.
Nothing wrong with either. I mean, no
yeah,
judgment.
For sure. I appreciate the Canadian openness. speaking of Canadian openness, dude, are you open to the $70, $75 price tag for Errol Spence, Sean Porter? What's going on here, man? I'm sorry, but I got to get this part of the discussion out.
It's you know, how long ago was it where even asking for $50 for a pay-per-view was like a big ask? And I'm just not sure at what point we turned the page where this kind of thing was acceptable. I mean, is it all in the framework of Pacquiao Mayweather was 100, so like we can go 70% as close to that for basically anything
that's,
remotely.
I can't think of any other excuse me, I can't think of any other reason than it's been slowly inched there. You know, and I can't blame Floyd Mayweather. I can't blame Manny Pacquiao. It's kind of like, in my opinion, it's kind of like blaming the rags at the supermarket checkout stand. Like, yeah, obviously they're putting out the product. So on some level, like, they don't have to put out that shite product that's tricking people, but they do. But nonetheless, it's like mitigate your own damage, people, and don't be stupid. And unfortunately, people are stupid, and, you know, they're buying this shit, and so they're buying – it's like I can't really blame them if people are going to be willing to do it on some level. But I just don't understand why people are willing to really do it, especially when in the last few years – like especially in the last few years, the pay-per-view model has basically been dismantled, or perhaps not even dismantled, obviously, because it's happening tonight, but it's been discredited. It's been shown to be not a good option for the vast majority of hardcore boxing fans. And so for some reason, we get this fight, and I don't want to shit on it at the beginning of the show because I like the fight. But in reality, and this is something that you and I have both discussed like several times over already for a number of these PBC welterweight matchups, it's a fight between two contenders. That's it. I don't care what title's on the line, belt, IBO, NAB9. It doesn't really matter because we still don't know for sure who the best welterweight in the world is. I'm not going to accept any argument about that. And so that's what it is. It's a fight between two contenders, or a fight where in almost any other era, any other significant era with, you know, even reasonably good competition in it, this would be a normal thing, a fairly standard fight, a fight that happens before a big fight, not the big fight. And we're still not only not guaranteed the winner of this fight versus Terrence Crawford, that is nigh impossible from what I can see. So not guaranteed. It's probably not going to happen. So it's like, where is this going? Where is this $70, $75 going? Okay, yeah, it's going to the fighters if there's some sort of upside or whatever, but I don't really understand. And this has been the lingering question with Premier Boxing Champions all along. And some people might say, well, that's kind of getting a little philosophical or dramatic about this one fucking fight. But this has been the thing. This has been what's stretched out over several of these kinds of fights is that, like, where is this going? Because you guys said there was this big welterweight tournament and everybody's going to face each other, and there's been like one of these fights per 9 months-ish for the last few years. So where's this going is the question.
I mean, it seems like where it was going was always about solidifying a power grab for Heyman. But beyond that, in terms of like the broader holistic direction of boxing, like what was the plan? What was the plan to improve the sport, you know, to drive it into a direction that was good for its overall health, to regain positioning in the United States in terms of its profile? What's been achieved with almost $1 billion of venture capital? What are the legacy fights we've seen? other than fighters getting paid more, which has nothing to do with them caring about fighters, or else you'd see much more of a push towards guaranteeing a union, guaranteeing health care, pension, better people covering the fight so people aren't dying unnecessarily, all the stuff that Hauser does about the New York Commission and stuff, just showing the levels of incompetence that are there safeguarding these people. But it was about increasing Heyman's own power. None of these people are cooperating. They're not creating tournaments. I mean, it almost just seems incidental when they do create a good tournament, and then, as you say, it just doesn't lead anywhere. And I mean, I agree. I'm excited about this fight. There's a couple of great styles there. Porter is always exciting. Spence is an extraordinary talent. But if it's not leading anywhere, and you're excluding casual fans, so you're not turning this into what it should be, which is a gateway drug into much more exciting headline fights, but pretending it is the headline fight, it's just so frustrating. And I don't understand this price point, because again, I don't understand why you have a business model. This is the thing that you would put on television to attract as many casual fans as possible, to showcase an exciting fight dealing with two talented elite level fighters. And the conversations that would start is, by the way, this is headed to this and this and this guy. But that's impossible to do, as you say, because there's no partnerships.
Well, and I apologize if I'm jumping in prematurely, but it's kind of like it leaves you nowhere to go when every fight is the fucking Super Bowl.
Yep.
How do you continue? Yep. Well, I mean, again, it kind of comes back to the supermarket rag idea, but how the fuck do you continually convince people that, well, yeah, that last fight that we said was mega extravaganza, welterweight, super Woodstock fucking Lollapalooza, actually wasn't. It was really good. And in fact, here's a 40-second highlight of the fucking 10 punches landed that were solid during the entire fight. And look how awesome it was. Yeah! Now, but that wasn't real, though. Hold on, because we got the real Super Bowl tonight. But then wait until 3 weeks from now, because then we got another Super Bowl. It's like, dude, I don't, you know, it's kind of like, where do you go from there? It leaves you nowhere to go. And then on top of that, it's like, not really true. Like, these are not Super Bowl type of things. This is a really good fight. And I don't want to spend all my time just crapping on it, because I do think that it's a very worthwhile fight. Like I said, it's a fight between two top welterweights, probably two, you know, top five, top six-ish, depending on where you think Sean Porter is at, whatever. It doesn't even really matter, but two top welterweights. And Sean Porter also has a very difficult grinding style that has a potential to take Spence off his game a little bit. We haven't really seen exactly that kind of tenacity from a guy from like Sean Porter, who's, you know, fought at 154 pounds a number of different times. He's pretty strong, et cetera, et cetera. You can talk yourself into believing that he has a big chance somewhat easily. But as you said earlier, Errol Spence Jr., supreme talent. And I think the vast majority of people believe that that is just going to be far too much for Sean Porter. So then again, you have a situation where the vast majority of people that I've seen are definitely picking Errol Spence Jr. emphatically, and then it doesn't really jibe with the promotion. And I have such a tough time reconciling that fact with the fact that there are so many people still just totally buying into it. It's difficult for me to almost like bring my brain to that level. You know what I mean? Perhaps it's just the cynic in me. Maybe I'm just a pessimistic shit. I know I'm a pessimistic shit, but it's like, I don't know how to get there. So I hope this is a good fight and I'm probably going to enjoy it, but the hype the promotion doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And then, I mean, we've got to differentiate the two things. We're not criticizing anything to do with the quality of this fight or either the fighters participating or the fighters or where this fight should go for the winner. We're criticizing exclusively the way it's being promoted and marketed. as something that just seems very wrongheaded and counterproductive and typical of everything that we can't stand about the way boxing shoots itself in the foot. That's our objection. It's not at all to the substance of this. It's just an item at the supermarket that we really want to buy that should be available at one price and should be, you know, in the real estate of the supermarket, it should be right in front of customers to try to attract as many as possible. And instead what they do is they have it in the back corner in the freezer, and it's five times or six times as expensive as it should be. Well, that doesn't make any sense from a marketing perspective. What you care about is not grabbing as much as you possibly can for this fight, but looking down the road in terms of Spence, if he's trying to position himself as this generation's Floyd Mayweather, is not a compelling sell at this point. Neither was Mayweather until he fought Arturo Gatti, you know, and just annihilated Gatti. You know, Mayweather's product didn't work until he had a really successful marketing campaign with his personality and what he was doing, you know, manipulating the media to talk about him endlessly and to elicit an emotional response from his audience that never was willing to pay to watch him win, and began to get people to pay to watch him lose, which he never allowed to happen. Full credit to him. But Spence, I think, I mean, realistically, even fighting a good competitive fight like this, where, yeah, he's the favorite, how many pay-per-views is this going to do, even if it was at $50 or $40? Is it going to do more than 300,000? I doubt it. Where it's at right now, I could easily see it doing less than 200,000. So he's creating a track record where he's establishing that he's not anywhere close to being a very marketable athlete in the sport, let alone transcending the sport. So I just, from every angle that I can see, other than the immediate short-term cash grab of this, I don't understand what the thinking is where people are going, yep, let's sign off on this. This is a great approach to go with a fight like this. It just seems stupid in terms of the way it's organized going forward. It seems dumb and just very misguided in the short term. It's very puzzling. And what a waste when you have somebody as talented as Spence to be in this position. I mean, when you get defined by the fights that you're not having and you're claiming that you're this extraordinary talent, I'm even hearing some of his interviews where he's relying on certain things to say why he's not fighting Crawford. Well, like, this isn't the only era where great fighters don't fight great fighters, so sort of don't blame us. Wrong approach. Wrong approach. Not that it's untrue. You know, Leonard ducked people for a while. Leonard was very manipulative about how and when he fought people. But do you really think that's going to win over new fans to come up with justifications while you're not fighting the other generational talent in Terrence Crawford? I just think that's a very bad approach. And I'm shocked that somebody wouldn't have that conversation with him to say, don't go out. This is not the way to talk to the media and get your message across. You're not going to gain sympathy and new fans with justifications about why you're not fighting the people you should be fighting.
Well, and I'm actually happy that you brought up the possible pay-per-view buy issue too, because this is something I tweeted yesterday as a response to, I can't remember who said it. It might have been Manouk Kupian from LA Times, but regardless, somebody had mentioned the pay scale, or at least the reported pay scale to the California State Athletic Commission for the card. And it said that both Errol Spence and Sean Porter had agreed to at least official purses of $2 million. I'm sure they're going to be making more than that if the pay-per-view upside is over a certain amount. And the upside's probably fairly low. You know, the limit or whatever is fairly low, I would imagine. But that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense, because from what I had seen, and it doesn't make sense for a few reasons, and I don't want to get it too much into the technical talks. I know this bores the shit out of a lot of people, and I'm sorry, but hold on, just bear with me. From what I had seen, a lot of the kind of like conversation between a number of the pundits and the people who track this sort of shit, like with pay-per-view buys and like interest in the fights and odds, they had said that they were tracking it somewhere in like the 300 range, like, you know, ish. And I'm thinking, okay, yeah, I mean, I guess I could see that because Errol Spence Jr. versus Mikey Garcia did like 300 or so. And okay, I guess I could see that. But then if you add that up, that winds up being $21 million if you're paying $70 per pop for the pay-per-view. The price I saw was 75. It's 75 for me anyway, but regardless, just round it out to 70. $21 million, and there's only, and then between Durrell and Benavidez, they're each taking $1 million on the books. So that's $6 million, mm-hmm. 21 minus 6. You know, you still have quite a bit to work with there. Like I said, I'm sure there's more going to the undercard, bonuses here and there for being good employees and all this type of shit. But regardless, it just, like, it doesn't really add up. And the reason why it also doesn't really add up, first of all, that would obviously be a really profitable show if you pulled 300,000, you know, buys, which is not a very big buy rate. But then on top of that, you look toward the purses that a lot of these fighters were getting for fighting far lesser foes. And that was basically on fuck around money on the network's dime a couple years ago. I just don't really understand what the thought process is to get from there to here and why the fighters would be like, yep, I'm on board. I don't give a shit. It's just weird. It's very culty, and I don't really understand how these numbers are all really adding up. I've read the breakdowns and all sorts of shit in Business Insider, and I think Forbes did one too, of the investment firms and whatnot that PBC is involved in. That's also boring shit. I just don't really understand, and it kind of circles back around to where is this all going? What's are we planning on just buying every fighter in the sport? Because I would say that if that's the case, that's also bad, because even under the PBC banner, it's taking quite a while for all of these PBC welterweights to hash themselves out. So that's not really something I want. As far as like Errol Spence and his likability, as far as his, you know, draw, whether or not people are really wanting to see him fight, the average American has no idea who he is, and I guess you could say that about most fighters, so that's not really a great measuring stick, but he's not going to be a guy, from what I could see, that is going to break through or be a crossover star or anything like that. He is likable, especially in the ring, but kind of bland. Very good fighter, so it would kind of be predicated on him really kicking ass or something like that, in my opinion, not so much a like heel turn type of thing, because all of the heel turns I've seen from him have almost been like unintentional, like just kind of saying crazy shit while super drunk in a couple of interviews and, you know, stuff like that. But mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I think that as far as how this fight plays out, I guess that could figure into how star worthy he is or something. I mean, is there a scenario for you that would say, like, for instance, if he came out and like pulled like a Jaime Munguia, you know, Saddam Ali kind of situation where he just like blasted the shit out of Sean Porter for a round or two and then took him out brutally in like a third or something like that, to where people are like, oh my God, like we weren't expecting that. You know, is that maybe a situation where you think it could kind of thrust him forth? Are there any situations where you could see that happening, or you think he's kind of just stuck where he is?
I think it's going to be tricky, because I think that one of the big things with Spence that's a bit of an issue, it's a positive, but there's also a negative component to it, is you pretty much know what you're going to get with him. He's not a surprising fighter. He's amazingly consistent with what his skills are, and sort of, I think he's one of the easiest people to predict the outcomes of fights with, because he's, the tool set he has is so overwhelming to his opponents that invariably he's an example of a great chess player who doesn't allow the opponent to play their game. And he's just not just remarkably intelligent in his strategy and how he implements his tactical approach to just dismantling opponents, but he has the skills, he has the body, he has the conditioning, the discipline, and the mental toughness to just impose all of these things. And we just haven't seen anybody really come close to being able to figure him out. So that means you're guaranteed, you know, the suspicion that he's going to come out there and find his way to win in ways that you're going into it pretty sure he's going to do. But I think unless there's that element of risk, it's really hard to sort of capture the imagination of fans. I don't feel as if there's any component to what he represents that is capable of capturing the imagination of fight fans. He's not one of those people. And he's also not one of those people. I mean, Mike Tyson, as Mike Tyson, was never an underdog against anybody that he ever fought, ever. And it didn't make any difference because the way he would win was what would capture your imagination. You never thought he could do to Spinks what he did. You never – the knockouts were so exciting. His skill set was so exciting and overwhelming of opponents that it created things that were instantly iconic and memorable and rewatchable, and you'd want to run and tell your friends to talk about what had happened. Spence isn't one of those guys, you know, so – he would have to – I think he's kind of in the position of Ali a little bit, who needed dance partners. It was dance partners that were dangerous that made Ali fights so amazingly memorable. You know, to think, how is Ali going to solve Sonny Liston? How is he going to solve Joe Frazier, George Foreman? Ken Norton is so big. How is Ali going to do this? That is what made, you know, those incredibly memorable fights with Ali, dance partners. And we just – I mean, that's – now the defining characteristic of Spence is, when is he going to fight Terence Crawford? And I think that that's going to harm him, because that's a fight where he'd be put to the test. And it doesn't seem like there's anybody else out there that will put him to the test in a way that will capture imagination. And by extension of that, drive people to be willing to spend money, tell their friends to spend money, and create a fan base that just is not there currently. While nobody denies his skills, nobody denies his place as a pound-for-pound elite fighter. But, again, I don't see too many people rushing to go back to his greatest hits. You know, none of those fights are really that memorable to watch. So I think it's just going to be a question of, does he want to go down the path where Mayweather was headed if he doesn't create a personality that's really compelling, or create, and to Mayweather's credit, create opponents that are compelling for us to feel that Mayweather's record is threatened, that we could get the benefit of seeing him lose despite all his hubris and all of that kind of thing. Spence right now seems more like a throwback fighter, except he's not fighting as consistently as throwback fighters did, and he's not fighting the level of competition that throwback level fighters did. So I think he's in a bit of a tough spot right now, and I don't really see how this fight really does much. Even if he wins commandingly, which already is sort of the prediction, isn't it sort of expected? Like, aren't all the critics just going to be validated with what they were prognosticating about? So, you know, even if he gets a first round knockout and absolutely annihilates Sean Porter, I think people say, go do it to Crawford. And then the response is, I don't know when I'm going to fight Crawford. I don't know if I can fight.
But it's not
Crawford.
His fault, because he's just
right.
A guy, and you know.
Right.
Well, and
that's just my sense of it.
It's really doing both fighters, both Errol Spence Jr. and Crawford, assuming Errol Spence wins, of course, a disservice. Ultimately, you know, it's unfortunate because. Yeah, I mean, these are things that we've been saying for a number of different fights now, but now we've gotten to a point where we have two fighters who are, at least on paper, at least in theory, pound for pound level, you know, perhaps not 1 and 2, perhaps not 2 and 3 or something, but, you know, pretty darn close. And again, we're squandering this opportunity, you know, two really, really good fighters. We don't really know what would happen if, you know, they fought, and that's literally what it's all about. Carlos Acevedo for Hannibal Boxing wrote a really good preview of the fight. I mean, he's a tremendous writer, as many people in boxing and in boxing writing know. But he wrote something in the preview of the fight that I just really agreed with. And ostensibly what he said was that Sean Porter stands to lose the least, pretty much no matter what happens. Basically because, I mean, he didn't really say this, but this is kind of what he was getting at, I believe. Sean Porter's the kind of fighter who has, especially in the last few years, shown that he's willing to fight anybody. He doesn't really seem to care who it is, where it is. He's pretty much good to fight whomever. And that's it, at least in terms of attitude, at least in terms of willingness to get in and mix it up. You can't really ask more of him. I've never really been a big fan of him as a fighter, like in the ring, I mean, like his style. I think that his style is just a really messy, mauling, kind of physical, strong-arming style, which, you know, there's something to say for that. And, you know, ultimately in the ring, you have to be the one to dismantle that. So you can't just put it all on him. But nonetheless, never really been a big fan. However, attitude-wise, can't take it away from him. So pretty much no matter what happens, we already know that Sean Porter is the type of guy that's kind of saying, well, if I get a loss, oh well. And if I get a loss, it's not really going to do that much to me as far as my career trajectory, because I'm still willing to fight whomever, and I'm still good enough to mix it up with almost whomever. And thus far, he's proved that. He still only has 2 losses and a draw. I personally think that there were 1 or 2 other fights that he could have lost and that were fairly close, but nonetheless, point is, he's in there. This, in that regard, kind of is a bit of a risk for Errol Spence. Not really, probably, because he's probably going to win, but it is a risk in the sense that if he doesn't look good, or if he in any way looks less than, or if in any way looks like, you know, not as good compared to Terrence Crawford, for instance, then the argument obviously is going to be, well, he's fighting Sean Porter, and he's not fighting one of these bum-ass dudes Terrence Crawford's been put in with on ESPN. But regardless, it's still good that the comparison's always going to be there, like you said. That's going to be dogging him, it's going to be chasing him, and we're still going to be in the exact same position we were in before. So, yeah, I mean, we keep coming right back to the question, where is it going? And I just really hope that it's going in a place where these people can shut the hell up and, like, let the fighters fight at some point.
Well, and I mean, there's always the option for, I think, Errol Spence Jr. to go from a big victory here to where he should go, which I think is bare-knuckle boxing against Pauly Malignaggi with a huge upside from those pay-per-view buys that Malignaggi demonstrated in the last fight that he lost. Because I think that's what fans are really clamoring to see, is the redemption of Malignaggi in bare-knuckle boxing. And it's a new frontier for Errol Spence, I think, to really assert himself as the greatest fighter in the history of bare-knuckle boxing. And, I mean, it's only been around for, what, like a year, so there's a real opportunity for him to do it. And I'd like to see him perform for that very, very erudite audience that we saw while I was stealing a stream of bare-knuckle boxing.
I mean, dude, there's been so many crazy, like, tidbits flying around in the recent, like, in, like, last week and a half or two. Like, you know, bare-knuckle, dudes going into bare-knuckle fighting. Nigel Benn's coming back. He's fighting Saki Obika. Nigel Benn's, like, 56 or something like that. You know, holy shit, man. Ripe for something awful to happen in the ring.
And there's a great announcer. There's a great announcer who hasn't worked in a while that if you go to, I forget the name of the supermarket, he's there right now waiting for an opportunity to come back to the big time. And if he's not announcing, he could be he goes by the name of Chappie Bobby Chez.
Bobby Chez.
Bring him in. Bring him in. He can do all three at the same time. He can commentate the fight while refereeing it. And at times, if he needs to, he can join in the action. It can turn into like a Survivor Series or Battle Royale or whatever needs to happen. I mean, who gives a fuck?
If they're already going there, I mean, they're having to go to like Montana or like Nebraska or something like that, where, you know, they're having to like have like a sniper tower looking for the authorities to make sure they're not going to get descended upon at any moment while the show's going. You know,
give them weapons.
It's high quality stuff. Why not? Haven't you seen that Russian shit where they dress up in armor and like they're for real, like hitting shit out of each other with maces? And I mean, why not, dude? Come on.
I mean, you could have Malignaggi gets to have brass knuckles and maybe like a revolver. Spence could have like a saber or something like that, like he can be dressed up like he's a fencer. And Bobby Chez will just give him like a broken down 1977 Buick, a couple bottles of vodka, and he's just driving around. Anybody gets run over by Bobby, tough. I mean, I think this would be exciting television.
Have you remember that movie No Escape, right, with Ray Liotta? And then like at the end, like toward the end, they get thrown into like the nasty pool. And then homeboy just like tosses a little blade in there and he's like, fight for it. And they wind up killing each other or whatever. Yeah. I mean, I think this is a legit idea, a pool.
I'd like, you know, and give Bobby a motorboat.
Why don't we just motorboat Bobby?
Yeah. You know, you could be in shark infested water and Bobby's riding around on a skidoo. Plow into some. Okay, we have to leave this alone. This is just going to never stop as we try and one up.
Yeah, we're supposed to be talking legit boxing here. So what's
legit
your prediction?
Boxing.
Yeah, what's your prediction for Errol Spence Jr. versus Sean Porter? So I'm guessing you're on Errol Spence. You're going to win, right?
I find it hard to think, and I love the description that Spence had, that Porter looks like a guy drowning and he's sort of like swimming to stay afloat or something. Because I was rewatching some of Porter's fights, and I mean, even rewatching the Malignaggi fight where he's throwing these wild left hooks, like jumping across the ring, it's very like Little Mac from Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. But I mean, still, it's fun. It's fun and exciting to watch. I mean, he's so much bigger and stronger than Paulie. It's something to see. But he is not a very conventional boxer. He doesn't seem like a very sound technical boxer, but it's part of what makes him really fun to watch. Like when I've seen him live, he's just such a big, strong guy. And he's so much under what should be his natural weight. Like that guy is meant to be 180, 190 pounds, right? Like he is such a built guy fighting at such a light weight class for his build. It's something to see, especially as he gets older. But Spence, I mean, barring some kind of real weirdness, a lucky punch or whatever, you'd think he'd be able to have a pretty easy time controlling Porter and just dismantle him, tear him apart, and get a stoppage would be my sense inside of six rounds. But then again, I mean, Porter lands one of these diving left hooks. But, yeah, I'd say 98% this goes the way I think most people see it. With Spence probably cruising to a very easy decision or possibly a late stoppage.
I think that was nearly, not the first part, but the last part nearly word for word, my prediction. It's just that Sean Porter, okay, in boxing, we've seen many, many times play out over, you know, decades and decades, that it's a sport of foils in the sense that we've seen many times that often the way to control a very wild, wily, bruising physical style, not all the time, but often a good way to control that style is an orthodox style, a style that's very linear, a style that is, you know, based more on a jab, long right hand, etc., just a little bit more textbook style, if you will. But, and then conversely, one of the ways to dismantle a very linear style is a very physical, brutish style, etc. So,
yep.
In this case, though, it's kind of like, all right, well, if that's being the case, where do we go? In this case, you really have to go with the person who's better at doing their job and who's more skilled. And that's really Spence. He has shown that, one, he's more skilled in the more classical sense, and he's also shown that in a number of different fights that he's gotten through fights unscathed using his skills, whereas Sean Porter, you know, basically doesn't have to, but if he's going to be successful and going to work to his strengths, basically has to use that style. in a couple of different fights, he's tried to box his way to victory, to mixed success. Many people felt that he lost the Uga fight, and he really tried to box his way to victory there. So I think that especially when you add in Errol Spence Jr.'s very heavy hands into the equation, we're probably going to be seeing a situation where Sean Porter, in his tenacity and in his lack of options as far as what he can do from the outside, is going to be trying to jump in the inside and get caught. I think many people have said things like that, yeah. And I agree. It's not really a thing where I think Sean Porter has quite enough punching power, quite enough strength to really make the fight and like to keep the fight on the inside and keep it mauling where he probably wants it. And he's probably not quite big enough to do that either, even though he is physically strong and very big for the weight. But I think that we will see that Errol Spence is just the better fighter, better at what he does. And yeah, that's my long-winded way of saying I agree with you.
Well, and I would just say, like, I think if Porter shows us something we've never seen before in the way he comes out, and like maybe he comes up with a plan of attack that's even more unorthodox than anything we've seen before, it would be like the biggest sort of unorthodox victory against such a sound fighter than I think we've seen since Mayorga just had Vernon Forrest's number. There was just something about that style where Vernon Forrest was bigger, longer, faster, infinitely more technically sound. He just couldn't figure out what the fuck was going on and was just overwhelmed by somebody who was just so up for fighting, such a talent. I mean, Forrest was a fucking killer of a fighter, but that was one of the most thrilling fights that I've ever watched live. I don't mean live that I was there, but I mean live in the sense of seeing it in real time. Because it was just like, this is what you love about boxing. It's just, did one critic see that coming? Did one critic predict, like, look, I think Vernon Forrest has never seen this style before, and this could give him real problems? Nobody saw that coming. Maybe Mayorga saw it coming, because he went in there as if, like, he expected it. I mean, from the beginning, just overwhelmed Vernon Forrest, which nobody had done up to that point. And so, do I think Porter has that in him to do? No, because nobody has that in them to do. That happens. I mean, that was 16 years ago that Mayorga did it. But there are certain things about just how physical Porter is that if he is able to sort of have one of the great nights of his career, be full of energy, just feeling amazing, and just able to keep his foot on the pedal the whole time, that you wonder, how is Spence going to deal with somebody who's really fighting him to win as opposed to fighting to survive, which is typically, I think, the mode he induces in his opponents almost from the get-go because he's just so technically sound. So, I mean, I would hope for something like that to happen because I think it's going to be the most dramatic result round after round. But that's a very, very tall order for Porter and I mean, that's what I'm a little bit holding out for, is that somehow he's able to sort of overcome all the odds and all the obstacles and be able to assert himself rather than constantly responding to Spence. And Spence is one of the best fighters in the world at forcing his opponents to respond and not be able to create. So it's going to be tough.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, too, that we're winding up having to spend a significant portion of the preview of this fight talking about the fact that, you know, it's probably not going to lead anywhere significant, or at least where we want it to lead. But nonetheless, you know, there's still a good chance that it's going to be a good fight in terms of action. We know that Sean Porter is going to push the pace. He pretty much always does. So it's probably not going to be a boring fight in the sense that, you know, it's going to be a fight where two guys are just sitting there looking at each other or something. Many Keith Thurman's fights kind of devolve into shit like that. So at least it's not going to be that. But yeah, it's there are a handful of things about it that really kind of either add asterisks or sour the note a bit. The price tag, the lack of direction. It's unfortunate, but hopefully it does wind up being a good fight. I did want to ask you, though, I'm not super into the undercard, and not much on the undercard really, warrants the $75 price tag either. But at the very least, the co-main event, whatever you want to call it, the co-feature, David Benavidez versus Anthony Durrell, is at worst interesting. I'm basically just, I see the name Durrell and I just want to curl up into a like snail shell, because I something bad's going to happen in every single one of their fights. Either it's they win and it upsets me, or they win and it's really weird, or some like foul happens, or someone drops from the rafters and like jump kicks somebody in the middle of the fight, or like there's a sucker punch. I mean, something always happens with these dudes, man. And it just like stresses me out so hard. I hate it. But I do like David Benavidez a little bit.
I like Benavidez too. And yeah, I agree with you with Durrell. I mean, it's a bit reminiscent of how I felt seeing Kid Chocolate's name on a card against Angulo and just thinking, the fuck is this? Like, why is this fight necessary? Like, where is this going? And do I want to watch this in real time? And I didn't. And the kind of worst case scenario of it is what ended up happening. And so,
oh my gosh,
I hate seeing those kind of fights, man. Like, they're so depressing.
I know. It's like I did watch it, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I did watch it, and I was kind of like, okay, I feel good for Angulo. He's getting a win. He's kind of like beating this dude up, but like, oh my god, this is only just going to lead to more like evil. Holy shit.
Yep. And Chocolate is somebody who made way over market value for what he'd achieved in terms of, you know, the opponents he was fighting. He barely fought, you know, like in his prime, lost his prime, and really sold out his legacy for some big paydays to be sort of protected. And then, you know, Danny Jacobs happens and he's never the same. And against a very faded Angulo, he looks tremendously shaky. Like, just that guy taking a punch is, it takes you out of it immediately, right? When you watch him take a right hand from even a faded Angulo, like, he just doesn't look right. He just doesn't look right. And so you just hope, like, those are the kind of moments where when they're rewatching that tape, whatever was going on in the moment of taking that punch, but when they watch themselves and just see, like, you're 36 years old now, even guys like George Foreman readily admit, like, at a certain point, the punches land differently when you're taking them. You just can't deal with them. You can't deal with body shots in the same way. You can't deal with those really traumatic flush shots. And you hope, because there's been a lot of, I saw some stuff on social media and I saw Peter talking about it, about him not being terribly responsible with money and a lot of people coming after him and stuff. And you just think, I hope he can walk away after this. It may be unpleasant to walk away from a fight where that's the result, but you've got a family, fucking get out of there, man.
Well, and that actually, you know, kind of reminds me and gives me a moment to, it gives me the perfect opportunity and the perfect little ledge to step right back up onto that soapbox for a moment. But as far as Premier Boxing Champions goes, I think that a lot of the defense of Premier Boxing Champions and Al Haymon has been that, well, he's getting fighters paid. You know, he's making them money. More money is going to the fighters. That might even be true. Number one, we
that
don't even
true.
Know. Well, we don't even know. We don't know for sure, because so much of this stuff is being kept kind of hush-hush, whether it's literally on the books hush-hush, or whether it's like people from this organization won't really talk, or they won't really be forthright, you know, open. So we don't know for sure, but nonetheless, even if it is true, you know, assuming it's true and we know for sure that it is true in terms of the pay scale in some cases, even if that is true, I'm going to try to really carefully say this, but you are handing vast amounts of money over to, by and large, a number of athletes who have never been taught to manage that money, whether it's as an athlete or as a person, simply balancing a checkbook, and that is not necessarily the kindest or most responsible way to quote-unquote pay fighters more or take care of them. A better way of doing it would be finding them managers who care, who make sure to jump kick off of all of the hangers-on, to steer them away from posses, who make sure that they make solid investments, don't buy fleets of cars, which are always awful investments, almost always, or et cetera, et cetera, dude. So I think that what you're kind of talking about too is like, it's the fact that if even if you are steering these fighters towards more money now, that might not be a great idea, like at least not in the way you're doing it. And Peter Quillin is probably a prime example of that, where just a few years ago, the talk was, well, damn, Peter Quillin's in the mix. When is Canelo or Golovkin or whomever, when are they going to get in with Peter Quillin? You know, because Peter Quillin's probably like, you know, Golovkin A, Canelo B, Quillin C or D or something like that. So he deserves to be in this mix, and now he's not at all. He's pretty much out. And so not only does he not have much to show for it on his ledger, but he got knocked out a couple times, or I'm sorry, he got knocked out once, but badly, and he got banged around really bad by a dude who shot just the other day, and then doesn't have money to show for it? Shit, dude. That's awful.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I don't know how many fighters I've interviewed in 10 years of covering the sport, but I know exactly how many have bragged about the money they saved as opposed to what they spent their money on. And it's two. Two fighters have ever bragged about what they save. So that doesn't factor terribly well into the future prospects of financial literacy on behalf of athletes. You know, and you know, you just wonder why somebody like Mike Tyson isn't more of a cautionary tale for these guys that, you know, they should recognize you're never going to be as marketable as he was. And every penny he earned, he ended up, you know, in the red by the end of his career. And I don't know that Tyson is the rule in terms of how these guys spend money or mismanage their money or are susceptible to being taken advantage of, but like it's a massive risk that you think the moment these guys would earn any kind of money. I mean, look at Andy Ruiz. I was listening to Andy Ruiz on the Joe Rogan podcast, and they were discussing the cars he's buying, and his attitude already seems to be like, this is just the beginning of a bunch of monumental paydays. Well, Buster Douglas broke the record for the biggest payday in boxing history when he fought Holyfield after Tyson. Do you know how many other big paydays there were for Buster Douglas after that? None. None. I don't think he made over $1 million probably cumulatively with the rest of his career. And I mean, the guy fucking fought for another, like, what, like 10 years or something? I think he made a comeback after the diabetes stuff. But, like, that's the reality. And these guys treat it as if, like, all my prayers have been answered and this is just the beginning. Like, it's a sign from God. And oh, you're just like, you wish there'd be a little bit more humility and fear. I mean, good example of financial literacy, and how often do we hear this brought up because it's not as sexy, Freddie Roach. Freddie Roach bragged to me about that he was still paying like $1,000 a month for the wildcard gym to rent it month to month. He was excited by that. He was still collecting $5 dues like himself. While he's working the counter of Wild Card, he really, up until like very recently, like never bought a really nice car. He was really big about like, you can lose all this. You can lose all of it. I ended my boxing career, pretty good career, with nothing. And I've had 21 world champions, and I've seen how many of them like didn't manage their money. That kind of approach to having some doubts, to being humble about what can happen, what you can control, what you can't control, that you'd think, like, I'd want him to go into, you know, classes with these athletes about what can happen when they start making money in boxing. And here's some things you could do just to protect yourself. But it's not as exciting. And a lot of these guys are real big time long shot gamblers at heart with their own lives. And the moment you sort of bring reality in, I mean, it's American dream bears some responsibility for that. In this country, we believe more in angels than we do in climate change. Believing in climate change doesn't make you feel very good with where things are. Believing in angels makes you feel great. So, like, I'm not surprised. But there's some harsh realities that are out there, and when the rule of most of these people 5 years after their career is that they have nothing to show for it and go right back to a very difficult, dangerous, problematic situation that they emerged from and worked their asses to emerge from, like, you just think, fuck, it's sad. And, you know, these guys get into your heart where you're really pulling for them to make it. You just wish there was more of a support network to assist them. But a lot of times once they make it, the people they're fighting off and sort of have to develop real armor towards are the people closest to them, their friends, their family, and all of that. And that's, fuck, that's tough, man. I mean, it's like that line in Traffic where Michael Douglas says the war on drugs means we're at war with our own families, and I don't know how to go to war against my family. And I think that people don't understand how that works. And Andre Ward said that to me after introducing me to a lot of his family members, was they all say that once you make the money, you change. The truth is everybody around you changes, and you just have to deal with it. And it was really, really hard to watch. And they weren't doing anything different than a lot of us would do, which is just Andre coming over for lunch, signing 100 things is like giving you $50,000 or giving you $10,000. So for somebody in a tough situation, how are they not going to just ask that? It just takes you 10 minutes to sign all this stuff. But from Andre's perspective, it was just like, all I am is an ATM. Wherever I go to my family and friends, I'm an ATM with a quote, with a signature or whatever. And like, ugh, like it's disgusting, right? But it's understandable.
Well, and I use the phrase cognitive dissonance a lot. And I mean, perhaps that's not the best phrase to use in some of these situations, but nonetheless, you know, you said it, it's not sexy to talk about financial responsibility or fighters' lack thereof, or, you know, the fact that that's the norm, to the point where it's a stereotype. It's a meme. It's a, you know, it's a comical representation of what fighters generally end up. And I mean, you start peeling back the layers of comedy on it and stuff like that, it's really not that funny. So, I mean, it's not to end the show on a bad note, but nonetheless, it's be wary of anybody in boxing that's proclaiming themselves a savior, a helping hand, a nice guy, anything like that, because this is not a sport where that's really a thing usually. So be wary of that stuff. And I think that we see some of that fairly regularly. It's just disguised a little bit. But nonetheless, as far as this actual pay-per-view goes, if anybody's actually planning on buying this thing, I mean, bless you. Good for you. In a way, I suppose that is on some level supporting boxing, and so good. You're not going to buy it, are you? Are you going somewhere to watch it?
I'm going to go to Times Square and watch it in the movie theater. It's become a little bit of a ritual with Kurt Emhoff and I. So, which I'm
all
not
right,
defending,
that's
I'm
reasonable.
Not saying you should, but one of my favorite things in my old age, post-40, is listening to Kurt Emhoff yell instructions to the fighters on the screen. I always get kicked out of it. Keep your hands up, Porter. What are you doing? And I just don't know anybody else who would do it. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's funny, but I find myself doing it more the more people I'm around who are like, I don't know, I guess it's maybe just the excitement, especially of watching fights like with other fans. But if it's just me, like I'll sometimes like talk to it, but usually it's like, what the fuck are you doing, referee? Usually it's something like that if I start talking and I'm watching alone. But But no, that's reasonable. Like going to a movie theater or something like that, where, you know, you pay like $10-15 cover or something like that. To me, that seems way more reasonable than a $70-$75. I'm just going to say that $70-$75. All right, I got it out. But yeah, that's better. I'm definitely not ordering it.
No, I think it's an inexcusably high price point. But yeah, I do get a kick out of going even to a movie theater. It's something I never thought I'd be into doing, but I've done it fairly, you know, a handful of times with Kurt, and it's fun to see it on a big screen. And I don't know, I mean, like, this is I just like we began, is just how the fuck are they not using this to build toward the Crawford fight? It's so frustrating. But I mean, hopefully they're able to find a way to figure that out.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's really what's next on the agenda, but hopefully that's even what they're able to put forth. I don't see it happening, though.
No. No, it's tough.
Well, I think that probably brings us to a close. We've spilled enough hatred, I think. Well, anyway,
I think so.
I hope for a good card tonight. I hope for a good main event too. I really do. So I'll try to leave on a positive note. But everybody, if you listened through our hatred and vitriol and Bobby Chez jokes, I don't know what's wrong with you, but go check yourself. Thank you, and enjoy the fights tonight. In the meanwhile, if you wouldn't mind following us on social media, specifically Twitter, follow Bryn at Brynicio. BRINICIO, and me, Patrick Connor, at Patrick M. Connor. And also, if you wouldn't mind going on to Facebook and liking the Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio page, that would be helpful. But we're also on all the podcasting apps and stuff like that, so rate us there, because that's, I think, even more helpful. Anyway, yeah. So have fun watching the fights, dude.
Thanks, man. You too. Talk to you soon.
All right. Take it easy, everybody.
You too.